Ready? It's about 12:59. I'm gonna get started with just a welcome and some housekeeping for our training today as people filter into the room. Recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. All of ITRC's webinars are recorded and they are archived on Clumen's website. Browse any of the additional training topics that we have and watch any of those trainings on demand. The Clumen training page offers the slides available for download under Download Training Materials. You can use the Q&A pod today to ask any questions, make comments, or report technical problems that you encounter during today's training. We will have one question and answer break at the end of the modules today. For those that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be provided to you. The feedback form can also be found on the Clumen training page. After my introduction here, I will be sharing the link to the Clumen training page in the chat for everybody. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Strategies for Preventing and Managing Benthic Harmful Cyanobacterial Blooms, also known as HCB2. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online guidance document of the same name produced by ITRC in 2022. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. ITRC's full disclaimer is available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide five, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today for our webinar. All of them have been volunteers for the HCB2 team, as well as volunteers for the training team, and have made this training possible. So I just want to take a moment to thank them for all of their hard work and time that they've devoted to this course. Their bios can also be found on the Clumen training page. If you would like to learn more about their background and contact them directly, that information is available on the Clumen training page. So with that, I am going to hand it over to Gina Laliberte with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to get us started on the introduction of benthic cyanobacteria.
Thanks, Devin. All right, and thank you everyone for joining us today. So you might wonder why we developed a separate guidance document for benthic HCBs. This figure shows the overlap between the 2021 planktonic cyanobacteria guidance document, which we refer to as HCB1, and the 2022 benthic cyanobacteria guidance, which we refer to as HCB2. So while much of the same guidance for planktonic HCBs applies to benthic HCBs, there are some unique differences between benthic and planktonic cyanobacteria that warranted development of the benthic HCB guidance document. Additionally, we have updated many of the resources from our planktonic HCB guidance document to cover both planktonic and benthic HCBs, which you see in this figure as the shared and updated resources where the two sets of guidance overlap. If you are not already familiar with cyanobacteria, we recommend that you check out the HCB1 document, which covers planktonic cyanobacteria, and review the HCB1 online training. You can find the Introduction to Benthic HCBs in Section 1 of the Benthic HCB Guidance Document. So today I will be introducing the visual differentiation of benthic versus planktonic HCBs. I will discuss ecological differences of benthic versus planktonic HCBs with a focus on water clarity and nutrient levels. I will review the habitats in which you find benthic HCBs. I will also briefly go over how these differences could present a challenge in risk assessment and communication, which will be covered in more detail later on in this training. So, to briefly review some of the basic information about all cyanobacteria, they are naturally occurring and are widely distributed across both aquatic and terrestrial environments. In both guidance documents, we focused on those in freshwater and estuary habitats. Cyanobacteria do have beneficial ecological roles, such as serving as a food source for other organisms, providing oxygen via photosynthesis, and some are able to fix atmospheric nitrogen into a form that's usable by algae and plants using specialized cells that you see indicated by the arrow. Cyanobacteria have some unique characteristics that help them to form persistent blooms, including forming resting or dormant stages, such as this enlarged cell that you see indicated by the second arrow. Planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water column, can regulate their buoyancy using the gas vesicles that you see as the dark bodies in the cell indicated by the bottommost arrow. These are lacking in benthic cyanobacteria. However, benthic cyanobacteria can sometimes float due to the buildup of oxygen bubbles within their mats from photosynthesis. So, what do benthic and planktonic cyanobacteria look like, and how can you tell them apart from other things in aquatic systems? We have a great visual guide to common harmful cyanobacteria in Appendix A of the guidance document and the Learn to Identify sex The Learn to Identify Cyanobacteria Blooms video on the HCB2 homepage. These identification resources have field photographs of blooms and microscopic images, and they cover cyanobacteria by what form they grow in, such as in colonies or filaments, and by what habitat they grow in, such as planktonic in the water column, such as in the photo on the right, versus benthic, growing on surfaces or sediments on the bottom of aquatic habitats, such as in the photo you see on the left. The identification resources also include examples of aquatic plants, filamentous algae, other kinds of algae, and pollen that can be mistaken for accumulations of cyanobacteria. The appearance of benthic cyanobacteria is very different from that of planktonic HCBs. Benthic HCBs grow as attached or loosely associated mats or colonies that grow on bottom sediments or other substrates. Mat formers are typically filamentous species, while colonial species are often coccoid cyanobacteria. Many benthic mat-forming species are motile, so you can see individual filaments moving within the mat when observed with a microscope. These species can reconsolidate into a mat if they're disturbed. Now, as you see in these photos, the colors of benthic cyanobacteria tend to be darker, ranging from olive green to brown or black, in contrast to the vivid blue greens and other colors of decomposing planktonic blooms. These photos also illustrate a spectrum of growth forms with thin crusts or mats in photo A, globular colonies in photo B, thick mats in photo C, and mats floating to the surface in photo D. Benthic mat communities can be somewhat uniform, but it's also common to have very diverse microbial communities within mats. Mat communities may include a matrix of multiple filamentous cyanobacteria, colonial coccoid cyanobacteria, diverse bacteria, algae, and protists, all of which are often in constant movement within the mats. Planktonic blooms can also consist of multiple species and strains, but in comparison, benthic communities can be very diverse. For example, in this micrograph of a benthic mat from a lake in Wisconsin, in addition to multiple filamentous cyanobacterial taxa, the mat community also contains small spirochete bacteria, purple sulfur bacteria, a diatom, and a euglenoid cell. Cyanobacteria are photosynthetic, so benthic cyanobacteria tend to grow in clear water where light can reach them on the bottom. Additionally, some species have adaptations for growing in lower light at greater depths. The growth of benthic HCBs in clear water may seem counterintuitive when compared to planktonic HCBs, which tend to be more prevalent in high nutrient waters that are turbid from abundant phytoplankton growth. In this photo from a lake in Wisconsin with very clear water, you see dark cyanobacterial mats that have lifted off the bottom and are floating with a surrounding bright green mass of Spirogyra, a filamentous green alga. Benthic HCBs can grow where surrounding waters contain low nutrient levels by taking up nutrients from sediment poor water or nutrients released from the aquatic macrophytes on which they grow. Cyanobacteria are diverse in their nutrient preferences, and there are many species, including benthic species, that grow better in low nutrient conditions. For example, benthic cyanobacteria are dominant in some nutrient-poor, pristine alpine and Arctic water bodies. This is in contrast to planktonic HCBs, which tend to proliferate in eutrophic water bodies where high nutrient levels support their growth. Benthic HCBs can grow on undisturbed sediments in slow-moving pools of rivers. They can also grow on larger rocks in fast-moving river water, as in the upper photo, where they live in the narrow boundary layer between below the turbulent flow that would dislodge them. These flowing water habitats are very different in contrast to the stagnant waters that typically support planktonic bloom development and accumulation. Benthic HCBs also grow in protected or deep areas in lakes and reservoirs, such as at the bottom photo, which shows a mat that has floated to the surface of a shallow protected bay in a Wisconsin lake. Benthic HCBs don't always stay in place. Oxygen production during photosynthesis affects their dispersion in water bodies. Oxygen production rates may be high enough in clear water that oxygen bubbles are formed and accumulate within mats, as you see in this photo at the top of Anabina in clear water in California. If enough bubbles accumulate, the mats can lift off the substrate and are carried away by river flow. In lakes, the bubbles can lift mats off the sediments, as illustrated in the lower photo. Physical disturbance can remove mats from substrates as well. In rivers, thick mats are vulnerable to removal due to increased drag and turbulence as mats grow out of the boundary layer and up into the water, into the flow. Mechanical disturbances such as wind, waves, boat wakes, and wading can also dislodge mats and allow them to be carried elsewhere passively by wind and currents. So some of the aspects of benthic HCBs I just reviewed can present challenges for communicating risks to the public and affect the public's ability to recognize benthic HCBs. We review this in more depth in the communication strategies in Section 5 of the HCB2 document. These challenges include the fact that the public may only be familiar with the appearance of planktonic HCBs. They may be unaware that benthic HCBs grow as mats or colonies, have muted dark colors, and appear to have lower apparent densities as floating mats or attached benthic mats in comparison to planktonic HCBs. The public may also expect HCBs to grow only in nutrient-impaired lakes or reservoirs with turbid stagnant water, rather than in flowing waters of streams or rivers, or in water bodies with clear water and low nutrients. The challenges of identifying benthic HCBs also play a role in the challenges of communicating about toxins and risk assessment. Like planktonic HCBs, some benthic HCBs species can produce toxins. Mats can pose a higher risk when ingested simply by their concentrated nature. Mats contain very high cell densities and therefore could possibly contain correspondingly high toxin concentrations. The risks can be higher for animals as they are more likely to ingest mats either intentionally or accidentally by drinking water containing mat material, such as the floating mats in the stream in the photo on the right. In the close-up photo of the 3 centimeter wide mat on the left, you can see how dense the dark filaments are at the mat edges. This mat probably contains hundreds of thousands of filaments with cell counts in the millions and potentially high toxin concentrations. So next up, we have Ruth Breland of the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, who will be covering the updated toxins section.
Great. Thank you for the wonderful introduction, Gina, to benthic cyanobacteria. And here I'll focus on cyanotoxins. Trying to also advance the slides here. Perfect. Okay. And I'm revisiting our overall Venn diagram for our HCB1 and HCB2 documents and noting that the cyanotoxin section is considered a shared and updated resource as these are common and produced by both planktonic and benthic cyanobacteria. So I'll speak much more generally. The additional points showing here serve as an outline for both upcoming slides, but also align with the subsections and order of the guidance document. So we begin with the important considerations for ways that people and animals can be exposed to cyanotoxins and the potential health impacts of that exposure. There are a few key considerations on where cyanotoxins are found or how they're distributed in the environment and how and also how long or how stable they may be. This in turn affects exposure for both humans and animals. I'll just briefly show the different classes of cyanotoxins where all the details are covered in our document, but I do want to note it's very important to be aware that there are different types of cyanotoxins with unique aspects and even different target organs and different health impacts. And finally, we'll delve into the development of threshold values for both humans, domesticated animals, based on different types of exposure. So when considering the risk for human exposure, we first think of ways that people interact with or around waters where cyanobacteria blooms or mats are present. Of course, being in the water, swimming, there's a potential for incidental ingestion. And in fact, the cyanotoxin thresholds for recreation consider that rate of how much water is potentially consumed during the time of a typical recreational exposure. However, studies have also found cyanotoxins present in aerosolized particles and even in the nostrils of recreators around water bodies. And this is one of the reasons that activities like jet skiing or water skiing are not recommended during an active bloom, as these activities can churn up and have more direct contact with spray from affected water. Of course, contact on the skin is another exposure route, and to minimize that risk, it's always recommended to wash after exposure to water and to change out of any swim clothes and shower after swimming, as that cyanobacteria, the mats or the filaments and cells can easily gather into creases, and you want to minimize that amount of exposure time. However, even when people are away from those water bodies, there is potential for exposure, as lakes, rivers, and reservoirs are sources of drinking water. And while conventional treatment processes are effective at removing cyanobacteria cells, the toxins, when present outside the cells, may require advanced treatment process. And in fact, we have had do not drink advisories due to cyanotoxins in the US and even in Ohio, where I'm from. Eating fish or shellfish that came from HCB-affected waters is another potential risk to humans and a very active area of research. And finally, there have been supplements with cyanobacteria that have had cyanotoxins detected and even resulted in recalls. As Gina mentioned, animals can be especially at risk. They can have higher exposure because they're spending more time drinking directly and even spending more time in those affected waters. They may also lack avoidance behaviors from blooms or even be specifically attracted to bloom and mat material. Animals feeding directly on cyanobacteria are perhaps their prey, so fish that feed on macroinvertebrates that contain cyanotoxins, and it has been documented for bioaccumulation of cyanotoxins in the food chain. Finally, incidental ingestion can occur even after exposure. The cells or filaments can get into the fur and feathers, and as they groom and lick those off, they can ingest them. So it's always important if you have had an animal get into affected waters to make sure they're washed off afterwards. In terms of health effects, the cyanobacteria are grouped, or cyanotoxins are grouped into the target organisms or the target organs. For example, microcystins and cilnidocytopsin are referred to as hepatotoxins because the primary organ targeted is the liver. And those cyanotoxins are more associated with pelagic blooms, whereas anatoxin A and saxitoxins that may be more commonly associated with benthic cyanobacteria target the nervous system. The effects and symptoms of toxicity, of course, differ based on target organ system. Information on illness outbreaks is reported and aggregated by the CDC, and their reports found that the most common symptoms are stomach issues, gastrointestinal illness, tiredness, and rashes or other types of skin irritation. Unfortunately, there have been incidences of animal illnesses and death that have been confirmed due to cyanotoxins, particularly for dogs that may be more sensitive or have that higher prolonged exposure. And finally, we do see it as a health effect to the environment with having that bioaccumulation of cyanotoxins in the aquatic food web, both in pelagic and benthic food webs. A few key points to make on where and when we find cyanotoxins and how they're distributed in the environment. As Gina said, the mat material can be very dense in cells and may contain cyanotoxins. In fact, there are multiple types of cyanotoxins can be produced or have been associated with a single type or species or genera of cyanobacteria. It's important to note that not all cyanobacteria are genetically capable or actively producing cyanotoxins, and thus they're quite variable in space and time. And though cyanotoxins have maybe been initially named by the type of cyanobacteria that they were initially associated with, in fact, research shows, again, that cyanotoxins are capable of being produced by a single species or genera. Oops, I think I jumped one ahead. Apologies. The cartoon showed here, it kind of demonstrates that cyanotoxins are generally retained within the insides of cells as depicted in that cartoon on the right where the little red triangles represent cyanotoxins. Of course, there are exceptions to every rule, and one of those is for Salinas-Mrapsin that's been shown to actively be transported through cell membranes. When cell membranes start to break down, either from natural processes or perhaps after an algicide treatment to a reservoir or with an oxidation treatment in the drinking water plant, the cyanotoxins have potential to be released. And the terms extracellular or dissolved are often used in association with toxin analysis. So a sample can be filtered prior to toxin analysis to determine that extracellular or dissolved portion. In the guidance document, we do publish degradation rates for specific types of cyanotoxins. They are quite variable from days to months, but it's important to note that those are tested for the extracellular toxin. While it is inside the cell, cyanotoxins are protected and can persist longer, even in sediment core samples, where we've had intact cells and cyanotoxins detected. On this slide, we're showing the different classes based on target organ and the different types of cyanotoxins listed. Those in bold and with the little red diamond indicate ones that we have published cyanotoxin threshold values for, and hence have more information on those cyanotoxins. You'll note that many of these are plural and end in S, and that's just to note that there are quite a few structural variations and also referred to as congeners for the same type of cyanotoxin. Toxicity has been shown to vary based on the structure. When developing the cyanotoxin thresholds, this is based on the concept that there is a level at which no adverse health effect would occur during a typical exposure scenario. Typically, the thresholds will be concentration based. For drinking water values, they'll be based on per volume, so that microgram per liter, or if it's in terms of biomass where you would be eating fish or shellfish, or even the estimates for mat material for domesticated animals, it would be in biomass, for example, nanograms per gram. The key components or basic components of that threshold or equation are the reference dose or toxicity, typically based on lab studies, and then uncertainty factors to relate that toxicity information to the reference population. Finally, these exposure assumptions. So how much drinking water is anticipated for different ages or groups, or how much incidental ingestion may occur during recreational exposure. It's also important to note that there are different periods that the threshold values may be for. So things like neurotoxins may just have an acute single exposure. Things like the hepatotoxins may have a short-term 10-day or 2-week exposure, and the World Health Organization documents also provide a TDI value considered to over the lifetime to not exceed per day for a lifetime. In terms of regulations and guidance, there, at least at the time of developing this document, no federal standards, for example, max contaminant levels for either cyanobacteria or their cyanotoxins. However, USEPA has published threshold values for two types, the microcystins and Salinas-Mopsins, for both recreational and drinking water exposure for humans. Many states have in turn adopted those thresholds or developed their own regulatory guidance values. The maps on the right show the states that had published threshold values and for which type of cyanotoxin for either drinking water on the top or recreational exposure on the bottom. The World Health Organization has also developed guidance for microcystin LR. That's a single structural variant of microcystins, anatoxin A, Salinas-Mopsin, and the saxitoxins collectively. And finally, we do have an example case study in this section about how you can adopt threshold values for MAP material and recreational exposure. While there are no threshold values for human consumption of MAP material, we are able to integrate those values into human recreational advisory limits. So the case study from Zion National Park, where they employed several different methods, first modifying the sampling protocol to be a benthic disturbance and represent the worst case scenario for water sample, and basically going in and kicking up and disturbing that benthic mat and then collecting a water sample for total toxin analysis, and also employing a passive sampling device for the presence of extracellular cyanotoxins. And then they also employed using a tiered advisory based on those concentrations and supplemental data. And finally, California does have MAT-based thresholds for dogs and cattle, again, based on that dry weight concentration as they may feed on it directly. And with that, I will pass the baton to Thea to talk more on monitoring.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Perfect. Okay. So for the portion of this part of the training, we are going to be talking about how you actually monitor for benthic versus planktonic HCBs. I'm also going to go over our method selection tool that we have updated since HCB1. And then I'm also going to discuss the basics of creating a benthic HCB monitoring plan, as well as the difference between a monitoring plan and a response plan for HCBs. So, there we go. Okay. So I think one of the main questions that a lot of people have coming into this training is, how does monitoring for a benthic HCB differ than monitoring from a planktonic HCB? So a lot of you might be here because you already have a planktonic monitoring plan in place, and you want to know how you can incorporate benthic HCB monitoring into your existing plan. And so one of the first key differences that I'd like to really point out is that oftentimes in planktonic monitoring plans, one of the first steps is conducting a visual assessment. And as you can see on this photo on the left here, it's pretty obvious when a planktonic bloom is occurring. However, benthic blooms can be a lot more cryptic in nature because, as is the name title, they can exist on the bottom of rivers and lakes, and they can be very hard to detect. And because of their benthic location, you're going to need some specialized equipment that you probably wouldn't use during a planktonic monitoring program. And that's because you need different tools to actually get a visual assessment on whether benthic HCB is occurring. And that could be things like using snorkel or scuba or something like a bathyoscope shown here to actually get a visual on a benthic HCB. So in addition to needing the specialized equipment to actually see a benthic bloom, you might need specialized equipment to help you accurately collect samples of benthic materials. And so you're going to need tools that can allow you to sample the bottom of your water body. And so those types of specialized tools can look like these Ponar dredges, as shown on the right here, or any type of equipment like a dredge or a rake that can collect material from the bottom and bring it up to the top for you to sample. In addition, when you're monitoring for benthic HCBs, the actual sample that you're going to collect is going to be a lot different than what you would collect in a planktonic HCB situation. So for planktonic blooms, we're often collecting water or foam. But for a benthic HCB, collecting a whole water sample doesn't tell you a lot about the toxins that may be present in the mat material. So when monitoring for benthic HCBs, you really want to focus on collecting that mat or periphyton sample. And so another special tool that you can use when monitoring for benthic HCBs is using an artificial substrate, as shown in this photo on the right. That's just when you place some sort of substrate out and you allow it to be colonized over time, and then you can consistently collect any periphyton material that may grow on it over time. And so that can be a great way to monitor for benthic HCBs. Additionally, I want to point out that different types of cyanotoxins are more commonly associated with this benthic mat material than you would see in a planktonic HCB bloom. And because of this, you might not be used to testing for, you know, benthic HCB toxins. And so oftentimes when monitoring for benthic HCBs, we suggest doing something called a PTOX screen, which is a potentially toxigenic species screen. And these screens help you to ID species that are present in your sample. And then you'll know which species are more commonly associated with which cyanotoxins. And this can kind of help you narrow down which toxins you're looking for in a mat sample. Thankfully, though, the underlying process and lab methods for analyzing cyanotoxins for both benthics and planktonic HCBs are the same. So if you already have a lab where you're using ELISA or LC-MS/MS, you can continue to use those laboratory methods for your benthic HCB samples. There's just going to be a very small change in processing mat material versus how you would process whole water samples. And so another key thing I'd like to point out that Ruth briefly touched on is that when monitoring for benthic HCBs, there aren't really any threshold guidelines that exist for some of the most common cyanotoxins that occur in these benthic blooms. Additionally, any values that do exist by the World Health Organization generally only apply to whole water samples. And generally, as I pointed out, in benthic HCBs, you're more interested in the mat material. So when collecting cyanotoxin data for monitoring purpose, just keep in mind that any guidelines or threshold values you might want to use, they aren't really recognized in mat materials yet, mostly just for whole water samples. So it can make it a little bit more difficult when you're trying to make recreation decisions based on threshold values for whole water samples. So while current toxin threshold values and guidelines are geared more towards planktonic blooms, there are other ways to characterize your benthic bloom. And one of those methods is using something called percent cover, which helps you determine bloom or mat extent. And so percent cover works by using a quadrat of a known size and monitoring the percentage of that quadrat that is covered in benthic material. And so once your benthic material covers a certain percentage of that quadrat, it can start triggering you to start testing for cyanotoxins. And so the New Zealand government uses this method to assess when they start testing for toxins. And this is a great field method because it can narrow down how many samples you're taking. You can kind of use the quadrat to assess first how bad things are before you jump straight into testing. And so this is another great example of a method that works really well for benthic HCBs, but wouldn't work at all for planktonic HCBs. All right. So when we're talking about building a monitoring plan, there are going to be several important steps that you're going to want to take. And these steps will be the same whether you're building a monitoring plan for benthic or planktonic HCBs. And so first and foremost, when you're talking about this monitoring plan, you need to decide what your overall goal is. If you are interested in public safety, that might influence the different parameters you collect on a daily basis. If you're more interested in bloom trends, you might be curious about the actual numbers of cyanobacteria in the water column at any given time, as opposed to wanting to know if there are cyanotoxins present or not. And so that will help you decide, what are you monitoring for, cyanotoxins or cyanobacteria cells? And then additionally, up front, you're going to want to think about how much your organization is willing to spend on training and monitoring costs kind of ahead of time. But luckily for you, HCB2 has actually updated our monitoring tool that can help you make these kinds of decisions ahead of time. And so this is actually a screenshot of what that monitoring tool looks like. And as you can see in the top left corner, the first thing you can decide is what your target analyte is going to be. So are you interested in methods that can look at planktonic cyanobacteria, methods that can look at benthic cyanobacteria, or are you only interested in methods that can tell you about cyanotoxin present? And because this is obviously a benthic training, we'll go ahead and unclick that planktonic cyanobacteria. And now you'll see that the methods listed only apply for looking at those benthic HCBs. And so this tool is going to give you a lot of helpful information right up front. And so if you look and see, it will give you information about the different type of cyanobacteria it can identify. So something like a visual assessment can give you an idea of presence or absence. It, however, cannot help you identify any species, but it can give you a good idea about density and abundance of cyanobacteria presence. But as you can see, a visual assessment tells you nothing about whether there are any cyanotoxins present in your sample. But it can be relatively low cost, and it can be novice to expert type of training level. And so if you are interested in just monitoring for cyanotoxins, you can go ahead and click that again. And now you'll see that the only methods listed are those that can actually give you information about cyanotoxins that are present in your sample. And so some methods are more thorough. They could do presence and absence and give you an idea of total cyanotoxin concentration. But if you are more interested in some of the stranger congeners that we see in a lot of benthic HCV blooms, then you could go down here and see that something like mass spectrometry is your option for trying to find out what congeners are present. And so this is a great tool to play around with. I would suggest looking at this before you got into details on your monitoring plan. And then, of course, once you've kind of decided the methods and the data you're interested in, you want to make sure that your field methods are going to complement those goals. And so thankfully, we have another handy table on the HCB2 guidance document that can help you make those types of decisions as well. And so if you look at this table, you can decide if you're interested in looking for planktonic or benthic cyanobacteria, and then you can find any method that is suitable for that. So something like a grab sample would work well for planktonics and benthics. If you are interested in using that artificial substrate method I described, you could see here that it doesn't work for planktonics, but works well for benthics. And you can also be more specific based on your type of water body and then the potential location where you would be sampling and different depths. So I would highly recommend taking a look at this table. It can be a very helpful tool when you're trying to piece together a monitoring program from scratch. And then, of course, after you decide on your field methods, you'll need to start thinking about practicalities like which sites will you be collecting at and how frequently you're going to be collecting these samples. And again, this is when it goes back into what is the overall goal of your monitoring plan. If your goal is public safety, you might be interested in monitoring sites that have high recreation potential. You might be interested in sites that have high recreation potential, such as along the shoreline. If you're more interested in bloom ecology, you might want to sample further out in the water column where you aren't disturbed by recreators. You might be interested in monitoring more frequently if you're trying to help recreators make informed decisions. It all kind of depends on what your goals are. And it's a really good time to start thinking about what you're going to do as an organization if this monitoring you do yields results that are above those recreation threshold guidelines that we've talked about. And so this is kind of when your monitoring plan turns into what we call a response plan. And so a response plan is going to be a separate set of actions that your organization will take in response to HCV-related events. And these events can be anything like a fish kill or a dog death or a visible bloom, or just if you have monitoring results that exceed those recreation threshold guidelines. And so it's important to take your response plan and outline ahead of time what actions your organization will take in the event these events happen. And you also want to dictate what level of either cyanobacteria cells per mil or what level of cyanotoxins is going to lead you into actions, and what action are you going to take. You really need to think about if your organization has the capability to close down areas during a bloom that are typically used for recreation. Do you have the ability to post signs everywhere? Are you interested in implementing some sort of nutrient management? It's important to think about these things ahead of time, especially to ensure that you have a consistent response every time one of these events occur. It can be very easy to go out and monitor a site after one dog death or illness, but what are you going to do if you start getting these calls more frequently? You really need to set up guidelines ahead of time so that you can have a consistent response every time. And so with that, I'll just kind of wrap up the discussion by saying a few things I'd like you to remember when you're making this monitoring plan. Just really think about what your goals are. I highly suggest using our selection tool to evaluate your options and choose methods that will give you the results you need to meet your goals. And always devise a response plan before you need it. And just be realistic about your monitoring and response capabilities ahead of time. And with that, I'm going to pass it along to Ben Holcomb to discuss management options for benthic HCBs.
Okay, thank you so much, Thea. Yeah, I'm Ben Holcomb with the Utah Division of Water Quality, and I'm going to cover our management criteria tool. And this can be found in section 4 of our web portal. So the goal of this section is to assemble the management strategies for treating HCBs, including benthic HCBs. So this encompasses both preventative and intervening approaches. The section is supported with an interactive selection tool to help you identify the most applicable treatment strategies and a compilation of fact sheets that describes the pros and cons of each strategy. Essentially, this section 4 is a recast of section 6 from our HCB1 document. And it contains all the same features in the web portal as identified in the HCB1 training, such as the strategy compiled hot linked table with PDF document download, as you can see here on table 4.1 on the right. So in this short overview, I'd like to cover the specific changes that have occurred in the interactive selection tool. For more complete review of the strategies, the tool, and scenarios on how to implement these strategies, just refer to the HCB1 Management and Control Strategies training module, which is archived on our web portal, and which we recently delivered last week. All right, first, with the management strategy selection tool, it's been cross-linked across HCB1 and 2. So both documents share the same tool. And here's a screenshot of the tool. Primarily, the tool has been reconfigured so it's easier to use. Essentially, the number of selection categories have been reduced. And because we're including benthic bloom habitat, rivers have been added as a water body type, as you can see up here. The variables that were initially part of the selection category has been provided as part of the table information, such as the level of supporting peer-reviewed documentation we have here, along with physical attributes of a water body for which the strategy is applicable. And the strategy fact sheets, hot linked in the tool, now include benthic-related content. So that was a quick summary of our management strategy module. And so now I'm going to transition over to our communication and response planning. And this information can be found in section 5 of the document. So the goals of the communication response planning section of the document is to assemble the best practices, resources, and examples of response planning and communicating benthic HCBs. The general practices provided in the communication response of HCB1 section 5 of the web portal and the associated training are unchanged with respect to benthic blooms. And so today I'll cover a few specific areas where new practices should be considered when addressing benthic HCBs. So during this training, I'll cover the companion information to HCB2, communication and response planning in these areas: reporting, notification, and coordination, visual observation and identification, drinking water coordination and planning, and advisories, outreach, and signage. So from the reporting, notification, and coordination content from section 5.1, a good first practice would be to consider new potential water bodies. As discussed in the introduction, benthic HCBs are more likely to occur in water bodies that are clear, or they may be found in flowing waters like rivers and streams. After completing this process, there are likely new key partners, stakeholders, and agencies that have connections to these waters. Now's the time to begin including them into your HCB program planning activities. Next is to incorporate this new information as provided from the introduction section, such as benthic habitat, characteristics, toxins, into your outreach and education. And incorporate benthic blooms into your overall public outreach. Particularly provide the emphasis on the exposure risks of mats versus the water itself. include frequently associated toxins. And finally, ensure that you inform stakeholders and respective agency partners related to recreation, drinking water, agriculture, and livestock producers. To assist your coordination efforts of incorporating this new information, we've added new benthic HCB imagery to our visual guide, and we've created a new identification video. So ensure communication plans are evaluated and emphasized to your stakeholders and collaborators of this new paradigm that benthic blooms can be found in clear water or flowing water like streams and rivers and not simply eutrophic waters. In addition, as mentioned in the monitoring training, there are new field and lab approaches to consider. So point your collaborators to the monitoring and toxin sections of the document and the respective trainings to understand these specific challenges and approaches to address benthic blooms. So the information that I just covered regarding bloom identification, habitats, and monitoring should be directly coordinated with drinking water providers. For instance, we recommend reviewing your plans with drinking water providers to ensure they address the nuance that benthic blooms create. As for private drinking water sources, it would be a good practice to identify and develop outreach materials as it relates to their specific needs and capabilities. And we have more information on this with examples and links to resources in section 513. Regarding your state or tribe's health advisory processes and guidance, it's important to evaluate these existing documents, particularly the advisory thresholds in place. We've discussed this critical review in the previous training modules. Due to the nature of benthic blooms, particularly how a sample may be collected, it's difficult to compare existing thresholds. Specifically, federal criteria are based as a concentration, whereas a benthic sample is more likely to be collected or reported as a unit of mass across an area. So what do? You either need to modify your sampling technique to generate a concentration-based sample or determine an appropriate threshold guidance for an area-based sample. Either way, it's important to incorporate this information into your existing guidance so that your agency partners, stakeholders, and the public that you are informing understand this nuance. In addition, as mentioned in the toxins training module, benthic blooms tend to include large concentrations of antitoxin A and its variants. Due to the unstable nature of these toxins outside the cell, you'll often encounter scenarios with low levels in the water and extremely high levels in the mats. There's also no federal recommended thresholds for antitoxin A or its variants. Ensure that the measures you collect are appropriate to issue an advisory under your current approach. And if not, what mechanisms and procedures are appropriate to issue advisories for benthic blooms in your area? Specifically, reevaluate your approaches to post advisories for benthic blooms and how those decisions can impact your current approach from using signs, press releases, your website, and social media. For guidance examples and resources like this table from Zion National Park, check out section 5.1.4. All right, here I'm going to discuss updates to your signage. Specifically, in regards to signage, the guidance recommends emphasizing and translating visually the differences between mats and water and the higher risk to pets and livestock producers. For instance, if you haven't updated your guidance to accommodate how advisories would be formally issued, you might want to consider creating alert or outreach signs to inform the public when these blooms are present and the risks they pose. See section 5.15 for examples and resources like this sign from the California HAB Network. So I've just covered a few specifics, but besides those examples and the compiled resources provided throughout this section, there are also three case studies found in Appendix B that provides more contextual information. So we have an example from Lake Travis in Texas. the internationally visited Virgin River in Zion National Park, and the Russian River in California. So the diversity of these case studies, both ecologically and their approaches, should provide useful context to your program. And finally, here's a list of all the available resources for you to consider. All of these can be accessed from the diagram found on the HCB2 homepage, which includes the portion that I just covered here just now, communication response planning. We also have these shared resources that I mentioned, the learning to recognize HCB's video, the visual guide. Also, each section or each part of our document HCB 1 and 2 both have recommendations. And then in HCB 2, as I mentioned, has the case studies. And then finally, they have these shared management strategy selection tool and the monitoring method selection tool that Thea covered. And all this information can be found at our website that I've highlighted here. So with that, I will turn it over to Devin for the Q&A portion.
All right. Thanks so much, Ben, and trainers for those wonderful modules that we just covered. So at this point, we are going to just jump right into our first Q&A, and get some of these questions answered. So the first question that we have in the Q&A pod is, are there any guidelines on how frequently samples should be collected in recreational waters like beaches? Should collection be done more frequently if there is an obvious bloom? Thea, I see that you marked this one as taking the first stab at.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah, so that's a great question. So obviously there's a difference between just doing regular monitoring, which could be done, you know, it kind of depends on what your goal is. If you're trying to monitor an area so that recreators can make informed decisions, then you would want to monitor more frequently. There is a lag time in between when you take a sample and when it goes to the lab and then when you have results that can be posted. So it's really hard to have real-time monitoring that can be done. But if that's what you're interested in, then yes, you could try to monitor. Our organization monitors about once a month. That's as frequently as we're able to do it physically. Obviously, if there's a bloom situation, you would want to monitor it more frequently to keep an eye on it, especially if it's actively at levels that are above those threshold guidelines. So some organizations will continue to monitor it until cyanotoxin levels go below those threshold guidelines. So it really just depends. I would say yes, if there's an obvious bloom, you should sample more frequently. But also, you know, sampling more frequently isn't going to make the bloom go away. So it just kind of depends on what your goal of sampling is. That's all I'll say about that.
All right. Thank you, Thea. All right. Next question. If sampling along a beach shoreline, are planktonic cyanobacteria a larger concern than benthic cyanobacteria?
Yeah, so I'll take another stab at that one. Again, this is kind of situational. Obviously, planktonic blooms seem to be a lot more common in saltwater settings. There can still be benthic HCBs that occur in saltwater. I don't really hear about them as frequently. It would just depend on what's occurring in your environment. If there's a planktonic bloom, then you should monitor it. I would assume that a planktonic bloom is more of a concern along a beach saltwater setting. But if you have a lot of mat material, then that would be the bigger problem, especially because dogs love to eat mat material at the beach. It just kind of depends on what's happening in your area.
All right. Thank you, Thea. Next question. How accurate is GIS-based HAB monitoring compared to in-situ data?
This is Gina La Liberty. I think what this person might be asking about is actually remote sensing using satellite data for HAB monitoring. And it really depends on what your goals are for monitoring. Satellite data are really useful for monitoring like a lake-wide bloom, for example. But when it comes to things like specifically beach monitoring, you just don't have that resolution in that near shore area that you need in order for accurate information. So how I would suggest using it is using satellite data to get an idea if a bloom is developing in a lake, but then you would need that in situ data at the beach to have the most accurate information that you can for beach closures, for example.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Next question. If testing for cyanotoxins, would a sample of the benthic mat be needed, or would the surrounding water be sufficient?
I'll take that. So again, it depends on if you're trying to make decisions based on any threshold guidelines that currently exist. So if you want to know whether the water itself is safe for recreating, you could test the water and then you would have that answer. But benthic material is where most of the cyanotoxins are concentrated. So if you want to know whether cyanotoxins are present, you should test the mat material. But that won't help you to use whole water recreation samples to make any types of decisions. And so testing the mat material is definitely useful, especially if the area is popular with dogs or with cattle or something like that. I would definitely suggest testing the mat material. Personally, within my organization, we have tested a mat and found it to have a lot of cyanotoxins in it. And then a whole water sample collected underneath the mat came back non-detect. So it really depends on what information you're trying to get. But with benthic material, I would suggest always sampling the mat material if you actually want to know about cyanotoxins.
All right. Thank you, Thea. Next question. How resilient are the toxic properties of cyanotoxins once the water body is drained and has dried?
Hi, this is Ruth. I can take that question. And I think it's really getting at what is the degradation anticipated for different cyanotoxins. One comment I do want to make when you say that the water body is drained and dried, if the like cyanobacteria mats or something are still, you know, present at the, you know, along the shoreline or at the base there, the cyanotoxins could still persist to some degree. And some of those filamentous cyanobacteria cells in benthic mats are quite rigid and can retain the cyanotoxin. However, if the cyanotoxin is present outside of the cells, the ones that are, you know, dissolved in water, as that water is like removed, you may only have some residual amounts that are retained. And just to give you an idea of the diversity of found degradation rates. So microcystins have a half-life of about 1 week, but that also depends on the pH or acidity of the water. So for more acidic waters, it can actually increase the rate of biodegradation. Things like Solanus meropsin typically have a longer lag with a half-life of 2 to 4 days. And then with the cyanotoxins associated with benthic cyanobacteria like anatoxin A, that is quite dependent on pH. But it is sensitive to degradation by sunlight. So it can be as short as a couple hours in alkaline pH, but if it's in total darkness, it can last for about 14 days. And then for the saxitoxins, we actually found them to be a little bit tougher and stick around a bit longer, from 1 to 10 weeks or even up to 3 months.
All right. Thanks so much, Ruth. Next question. The image of the visual inspection of benthic at Utah shows the inspector wearing a face mask. Is that because of the COVID-19 impacts during the time of the inspection, or were there airborne toxics from the bloom, or both?
Yeah, so that's a great observation and a good question. At that time, that was during the early stages of COVID, and everyone was wearing masks at that time. We have consulted prior to COVID, we have consulted with specialists that deal with, airborne toxins and how to best protect ourselves. And we've been recommended to not wear masks because it gives you a false sense of security. So in this sense, or in this instance, it was mainly to protect ourselves from each other and not necessarily from the toxins. It could be a good practice to wear a face shield, particularly if you're out on a boat and you're collecting samples that way. to kind of avoid being splashed in the face. But a mask isn't going to really provide that kind of protection from cyanotoxins. So.
Yeah, right. All right. Thank you, Ben. Next question. Although HCVs can produce the same cyanotoxins, whether benthic versus planktonic, is the recreational exposure risk less for benthic HCVs compared to planktonic HCVs? Would you recommend different cyanotoxin criteria or thresholds if a water body is more susceptible to one versus the other?
I can take that. So I think that it's hard to say whether one is more risky or less risky. It kind of depends. I would say that, you know, planktonic HCVs, obviously you wouldn't want to swim in water that has a planktonic HCV, but that would be very obvious. So I think people would be more prone to avoid areas like that. It would still be risky for dogs, obviously. They would know to avoid that type of water. Benthic HCVs, because they are cryptic, I think can pose a very big risk, especially to dogs, because owners won't think twice about entering the water because it will look safe. It's really just that mat material that a dog could come across. And so it could pose a big risk to dogs that ingest that mat material, whereas human beings are not going to eat any weird mats that they find. So it's not as much of a risk for humans. So again, I realize it's kind of a non-answer, but they both have their own risks that are associated with them. And then, yes, some of them do produce the same cyanotoxins. So you have the same level of risk in terms of which cyanotoxins are present. I would say just really paying attention to the threshold values that California and I think Oregon have set out for that mat material is your best bet to really look at that as your criteria and threshold guidance for benthic HCVs.
I'm just trying to find my unmute. Thanks so much, Dia. All right, we got one final question here, and then we are going to wrap up our webinar for today. Have any of the three studies used citizen science groups to support the inspections, sampling, et cetera? If not, where else has citizen science been or continues to be a significant aid in HABS notifications?
Yeah, so I will say, this is Ben from Utah, I will say that with, in particular, the case studies, I'll just say on behalf of like the Zion National Park case study, that was primarily triggered because of a dog death and not necessarily because a citizen observed it prior to any notification. But we do in our state have a built-in relationship with our local university who coordinates citizen science through aquatic monitoring, water quality monitoring, and through them, they have routine places that they visit. And then also, we have a really extensive outreach program. And so the majority of our identifications now come from the public because they are familiar with what to look for. And we have, we use our kind of emergency spill line that the public accesses and provides the information that triggers us to conduct evaluations.
All right. Thank you, Ben. So with that, we're going to wrap up our webinar here today. I would just like to take a moment to thank our attendees for joining us and our trainers for being here and making this possible. If you would like any clarifications on any questions or responses provided, or if you have any additional questions you'd like to ask, feel free to get in touch with us at itrc@itrcweb.org. We'll follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. We'd love to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that I did put in the chat and is also listed on the Clue-In training page that did bring you here today. Filling out that feedback form is also going to be how you get a certificate of completion for today's course if you are interested. So with that, I will just wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day and thank you again for joining us today. Trainers, thank you so much.